This presentation was recorded at Closure West in Portland, Oregon. This audio file and others like it are available for free download at InfoQ.com.
Welcome to my talk. I'm Alan Dipert. I work at a company called The Fresh Diet, where we're doing amazing things. Blowing minds, handshaking, kissing babies, everything amazing you can imagine we're doing there. And I'm going to talk about a small part of something we've been working on that may be useful to you. A couple notes before I begin. First, FRP is an acronym. It stands for Functional Reactive Programming, and it has two definitions. One is a fairly specific definition related to a model in computer science having to do with reactive programming techniques. And the other is, it's kind of a battle cry for people who are in ClojureScript or somewhere, some environment that has constraints around asynchronous reactive programming, and we're all sort of attracted to this acronym. I don't know what it is. You know, at the UN session yesterday, FRP, people who didn't even know what the acronym stood for came. So there's something very appealing about this arrangement of letters on the screen. I don't get it. My little warning around those two definitions is I tend to toggle between various definitions of the acronym. I might be talking about, you know, reactive programming techniques or data flow or something more general, or maybe I'm referring to, you know, FRP, the very specific model, which I hope to cover pieces of. Sorry, I can't help it. But hopefully you'll know what I'm talking about. Let's begin. So I wanted to start off with something very, very impressive. So I went ahead and wrote this little diagram. It's a high-level architectural diagram of every system you've ever designed and every program you've ever written. So, you know, my invoice is in the mail. You're welcome. I know your boss has been wanting one of these for a while. I went ahead and did it. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, here's your system. Here's your web system. What do we have there? Well, we have a bunch of components with dependency relationships. So what is this graph? It's a dependency graph. Of course, I actually made the diagram before you switched to Atomic. Of course, we all know, you know, application-level cache. It's ridiculous. So I got this idea from, there's this musician of some note affiliated with our community. He gave a talk at the ClojureConj last year, and he invoked this diagram, which struck a particular chord with me because I was actually had a tab open with the Wikipedia page where this image is. It's on the topographic sort thing. And I was there because that's a part of the implementation technique for functional reactive programming, this mysterious thing. And I was kind of struck when I saw it in Rich's presentation, and I realized, well, you know, systems are these directed graphs as well. Our programs are made out of components that have dependency relationships, and so are our systems. So I won't say much more about that other than I think there are aspects of reactive programming, the larger field, and data flow, sort of lessons that can be plucked there and applied to higher-level designs that, I won't go into, but I encourage you to dig in. Okay, so now here is the same graph. This is the graph of every program you've written. You'll notice that the branches are functions, the leaves are values. Now, this isn't quite enough meaning to run it yet. You know, branches are functions, leaves are values. There's almost enough here to run this. We need to invoke something called the applicative programming model. And I have a little example of what that looks like with an awesome computer language closure. So, you know, we know, and this is sort of Lisp 101, we write our code in these S expressions, lists, that convey a notion of order. You know, we don't need infix rules or precedence or anything like that because it's very explicit in the way we write the code. The dependencies are, we express syntactically. So these lists break into these graphs. The topmost thing is, you know, plus, and then we have 1 and 2 and 3 and some things. How do we evaluate this? What are the semantics of evaluating this? Well, first, did something blink? Did the one blink? Great. That's great, because that's the first thing that gets evaluated. We start at the arguments of the function that we're invoking. We're invoking plus here with some arguments. We move through the arguments left to right. The next argument is this compound expression, another function call. So we need to evaluate its arguments before we can evaluate it, so then we hit 2. And then we hit 3. Now with 2 and 3 evaluated, we can apply them to multiply. Effectively, that multiplication little node gets replaced by the result of that 6. And now we have enough arguments in place to evaluate the rest of the tree. Apply 1 and 6 to plus, and that's it. Our program has run. Awesome. This is great. This is the way we're used to programming. This is how most programming languages work. In fact, I'd be surprised if you ever use a programming language that is not applicative. All right, so steps, evaluate arguments. Our syntax specifies the order we would like evaluation to happen in. We apply these arguments to functions. And one point of note with the applicative model is that there's no intrinsic notion of time. We don't have the tools to express necessarily any notion of time beyond the order that we've specified, the order that these processes are supposed to happen in. It's not strictly true. In Clojure and Common Lisp, one thing the semantics of those particular languages tell us is that arguments get evaluated left to right. But if you have to worry about that, I won't help you fix that bug. That's weird. So, reactive programs. So now we're in a world where we don't know necessarily all of the arguments that we need to do the work that we need to do. For instance, the value at the question mark, maybe that's an input field on a web browser or a UI field on some Swing application where we don't have a value yet from the user. If we're on Clojure on the JVM, we can do something very straightforward to add the extended notion of time that we need to represent this process. We can block. We can say, well, the evaluation stops until there's a value there. And in Clojure on the JVM, we have a lot of tools to do this kind of modeling, to extend the applicative model, introduce this notion of time we need. Blocking is kind of nuanced because it extends transitively to other parts of our graph that rely on that subgraph that's blocked. Now, again, this is potentially another pickle because now our whole program is blocking, basically. The top-level thing is blocking, and everything is stopped. And in fact, this is one of the common gotchas with UI programming, is now with everything blocked, it's actually impossible for the person to input the argument that will unblock it, which is why Swing has a separate UI thread and stuff like that. Yeah, so UI thread. Oh, here's a way that we can do this blocking in a way such that it doesn't block the rest of our program. We can put it in a thread. Now, we have threads on Clojure on the JVM. We're used to hearing about them actually as they relate to Clojure, mostly as sort of a performance thing, like reducers and multi-core. And generally, at least in my mind, until I sort of dug into this, threads were like, well, yeah, multi-threaded, multi-core, that's like a performance number crunching thing. Threads are actually also a conceptual tool, a semantic tool for expressing concurrency that has meaning in not necessarily a performance way, but in a way of expressing concurrent computation. And again, Clojure gives us fantastic tools, as does the JVM. And this is why threads are useful, even if they're not real hardware threads. This is why some languages have green threads. The justification is, well, threads give us this extended notion of time. So even though they don't necessarily map to multiple cores, they're still there to use. So we can structure large programs that may have blocking, little periods of blocking, without blocking our main parent thread. That's because we can count on our system to schedule these things and never fully block whatever the parent program is. And again, in Clojure, we have fantastic tools, not only for spawning threads and shutting down threads. We have concurrency constructs for expressing these kinds of workflows in a way that doesn't even force us to talk about threads, like future or agents. And then we have awesome tools for getting data from those threads, in atomic, consistent ways. It's a really great story. So, the model, applicative evaluation plus threads, gives us the ability to express dependency relations in programs, and it gives us this extended notion of time that is very useful when we're doing things like writing UIs or really in any scenario where we have a sort of domain-level notion of concurrency that, again, is not necessarily related to performance. It's related to this is a sensible way to model whatever my problem is. Functional reactive programming is a programming paradigm, often a language-level thing, often a library. It's so many things. Again, this acronym. I don't know. It's the acronym that keeps on giving. Keeps on confusing. It gives us the same tools, the ability to express order and an extended notion of time that lets us build programs. The one thing functional reactive programming does not require is language support for threads or any kind of concurrency construct in whatever your language is, which is appealing to those of us in ClojureScript and working in JavaScript. So what does reactive evaluation of the same graph look like? Well, suppose we're, again, in the same situation where we have an input. We're either don't have a value at the spot and can't evaluate, or we process the previous value and we want to initiate evaluation of this when there's a new value at that position. The first thing our FRP or reactive evaluation system will do once a value is available is evaluate it, but in the same order that it would get evaluated if we were just in a regular applicative setting. So this value is available. The order of the evaluation is the same. And you'll notice that this evaluation is happening with values from the point in time that the number 4 became available. And that aspect of FRP is what's known as consistency. As these values appear, they are pushed through, evaluated, such that the values are correct with respect to when they appeared. Notion of consistency. So evaluation continues, and then plus gets run. But we hit kind of a problem here, because nobody called necessarily, nobody called the top-level plus. Because we're initiating evaluation not by being called, but by there being arguments available. So now we have this result from this computation that happened. What do we do with it? Well, we have to tell the FRP system what to do with it. And you know, for those of us in the browser, that's often, oh, there's a value there? Yes, please put it in the span with the ID of you know, new result or whatever. So often, the sort of pinnacle of these FRP graphs are, okay, blip that out to the screen or the DOM. So reactive evaluation maintains the dependency order of our processes. What this gives us the ability to do, or the promise of functional reactive programming, is we can express processes and computation and the dependencies between them the same way we're used to. Translation, we can write code that looks like normal, regular code. But instead of triggering evaluation of this graph by somebody at the top invoking it, that evaluation is triggered by the availability of arguments, pieces that need to be in place in order for it to happen. The promise is that we can write programs in this style with these FRP libraries, and our programs will look and feel very familiar. And of course, we don't need threads to write in this way. So in addition to arguably providing us with some other conceptual benefits, there's a runtime requirement that FRP does not need that, you know, is, again, very useful for us in environments where there aren't threads, such as JavaScript. So browsers today do many, many things. They do a lot of things. They probably do more things than they need to do. And not enough of the things that we need them to do. In particular, JavaScript, the language you know embedded in browsers, has a very strange event model. Nominally, all calls are asynchronous, and there isn't actually any way to block a JavaScript VM except with a while loop. It's a very hard and terrible way to lock. So there are these callbacks all over the place. Another aspect of programming in the browser is there's this thing, the document object model, which is a couple things. One, it's our input-output gateway to and from the JavaScript program where our program is running. It's how we display things to the screen, and it's often where events come from, at least in the sense that you're probably attaching event handlers to objects in the DOM. One way to look at the DOM is an extension of the state of your application. It's an extension of your application's, you know, namespace. Except everything in the DOM is global and mutable. So as far as a place to store data, it's an absolutely terrible place. And I think, you know, we've seen more than a handful of people have presented ways of working with the DOM. And I think everyone will agree that the DOM is not where you want to keep your application state. I've joked before that the DOM is kind of like an outhouse. You go out there, you do your business, and you go back inside as soon as possible. You don't want to hang out in the DOM too long. Stinky. So, I'm not going to talk about the DOM. One of the things about Javelin, this library that we wrote, is that it doesn't imply anything about however you know do your business in the DOM. Now, we have a tool we call HLisp, which is a whole other thing. My friend and associate, Misha, wherever he is, wrote it. It's basically a HTML syntax front end for the Clojure compiler. So it's kind of a nerdy thing we do. We take our HTML, we compile it into Clojure script, and then link it against our program. It's pretty sweet, but I'm not going to get into it. It's on this URL. Check it out at your leisure. Wholly undocumented. Works for us, though. Feel free to ask questions. Okay, so we have familiarized ourselves with the problem. We have familiarized ourselves with the promise of FRP. It lets us write programs in a way we're familiar with and, you know, gives us the ability to write those programs such that they're reactive. What is the proper FRP model? Well, it has these two objects in it. The first kind of object is called an event stream. An event stream is a sort of sequence-like thing that can represent zero or more events over a time axis. Now, where, you know, Clojure sequences, lazy sequences, represent values over an axis of consumption, particularly lazy sequences, you ask for the next one and it is given to you. Event streams, you don't ask for the next one. It just happens. The next one appears. So, effectively, they're infinite sequences and you have no control over when things appear, unless, of course, you know where the events are coming from. Event streams can be attached to other event streams such that when an event happens on them, they will trigger the processing of the event on any dependent event streams. So they're a tool for wiring together these workflows of events. Behaviors are the other kind of object in this class, you know, this functional reactive programming model, and this is the, you know, I'm talking now, of course, about the proper computer science definition. Behaviors are an object. They're also called signals in some of the earlier papers. They're sort of like refs. They always have a value, which is an important aspect of reference types in Clojure. They're different from reference types in that they automatically update the function they contain when any of the other objects that they depend on's value changes. So they're sort of like an automatic, fancy ref. You attach them to sources of change, and you throw a function in there to run on those sources of change when the change happens, and they will internally and automatically update their own state. They do this in a way that is achieves that property of consistency. So it's the FRP system's job to maintain this graph of event streams and behaviors you have built on your behalf such that you are empowered to write code that looks applicative but is reactive. There are a set of operations on each of these kinds of objects. Again, streams are very sequence-like, so most FRP libraries give you things like filter, map, merge, zip, drop, stuff like that. Each type of object usually comes with a function for converting it to the other kind of object. In the case of an event stream, to convert an event stream to a behavior, you supply a value, an initial value. And that's because event streams may not have had an event fire on them, and they may be without a value. In order to be a behavior, they need one. So this starts with a function. We'll take an event stream and an initial value and hand you back a behavior. Behaviors have these two fundamental operations. The first is lift, and that's the process of taking a regular Clojure function and some number of dependencies, which can be either event streams or behaviors, and doing this lifting operation, sort of lifting the function to the FRP level. It wraps the function with another function that's smart about dependencies. Lift, obviously, you know, is a term from like monad stuff. There's some relationship to monadic lifting, but it's not particularly useful as far as I can tell. The other thing you can do is take a behavior, call this changes function on it, and you get back an event stream of the changes to a behavior's value over time. So you can convert a behavior to an event stream and an event stream to a behavior. So what does this look like? All of the code or small fragments of function names and stuff I've shown are from a library called Flapjacks, which is one of the more popular FRP libraries. It works in JavaScript. It's a very nice library, and it was highly informative. So we have here a small program, the beginnings of a program, a skeletal Clojure script application. No Clojure script yet. We're just looking at a fragment of HTML with two inputs and a span to put some result, and the rendered result of that. So it's a little calculator. So we have the rendered thing at the top, and in the Clojure script little area, we're looking at a short Clojure script program that is using the Flapjacks library, which is very straightforward to do. And we've aliased it in as capital F, that stands for Flapjacks. That's our clue that that's the Flapjacks namespace. And we're calling some functions here. Our first function is called extract float e. The name there is Super Poor Man's Typing System. The capital E means it returns an event stream. So you can do a kind of manual static type checking. It's, you know, and of course, I do internally, I have, like, Hindley Milner, like, awesome inference, like, happening. Yeah. So that's just the convention. Flapjet itself follows that convention, and when we use it from ClojureScript, we do the same thing, because it's useful to know what type of thing the function returns. So here we're mapping over some event stream that represents values extracted from some DOM element. We're mapping over this function parseFloat, which is presumably some helper function we have somewhere. So we're using this extract float E to map the value of an input to a named object in this let statement in the closure code, N1, an event stream of values of that input. We do the same thing for this input. Now we have N1 and N2, both event streams of values. Finally, the last line, that sum, we're lifting the plus function, passing it in N1 and N2 as dependencies, and naming that sum. And that's going to be a behavior that will always have the value of whatever the sum of these two constituent event streams are. And then finally, we use this insert value B function that's a helper that will take a behavior and insert the value of that behavior into HTML as the value changes. A couple things to note. I turned on ceremony mode here so we can very quickly see the ceremony involved in doing this. Well, you know, we have the whole E and B thing. We're calling both functions that return event streams and behaviors. And that's kind of not cool. There's kind of an explosion of functionality, even just with two types. So then they have whole classes of functions dedicated respectively to them that we need to know about and work with. So we see E and B. A little confusing. The rest of it, seems reasonable. What's really important is this. This is the part of this code in which the promise of FRP is being fulfilled, which is we have an expression here that looks like regular Lisp code, almost. There's that lift thing happening. But if we chop that off and look at just this expression, like that's the Holy Grail. That's what we want. We want to write reactive code that looks like applicative regular Lisp code that we're very used to writing and reading, and we're very close to achieving that with flapjacks. Which is great. There's another place you can look at if you're interested in Holy Grail, which is spreadsheets. Check it out. There's also an environment that has nothing to do with FRP and that we're all very, very familiar with, where we get ultimate concision. This is a reactive programming environment. We're expressing a formula. It's as short as it could possibly get. I mean, granted, it's infix, so I'll never use it. But it's there, and that's kind of amazing. So these spreadsheets, they've been around all along. We're writing these applications using really, you know, interesting but complicated functional reactive constructs. What's the deal with spreadsheets? What's the model there, and why aren't we using them? You know, can they be extended? Can they run the browser? What's the deal? Well, the deal with spreadsheets is this. They have also two, really one kind of object, but each kind of object has different semantics under different conditions. So kind of nuanced. You have input cells. These are the cells where the user will type in values. You know, this is where you actually double-click in there, you type in a new value. And, of course, you have formula cells. And formula cells, you say equals, and then some mathematical infix formula. And the formula cells are linked to input cells, and the formula cells update automatically as constituent cells themselves update. This is exactly the behavior we want. So, again, if they're so awesome, why do we even care about FRP? The difference between them is a difference in the ways they propagate. This is kind of a, propagation is kind of this, it's a word for this cranking of the evaluation mechanism, whether it's in a spreadsheet or in a functional reactive system. There are two possible semantics. The first is continuous propagation. This is what spreadsheets do. Spreadsheets only do stuff when the values in the input cells change. For instance, if I have a spreadsheet like the one we saw, and I go into the little box that has a zero in it, and I double-click in there, and I backspace the zero, and then I type zero in again, nothing will happen because the value has not changed. Only the change in a value in a particular cell will cause propagation in a spreadsheet. FRP evaluation can be either continuous or discrete, where discrete introduces a more concrete notion of time into your model. And I think it's for that reason that a lot of people who have been doing FRP see it as the more general thing. You know, well, spreadsheets are very cool and intuitive, whatever, but they can't do discrete propagation, and we need that for X, Y, Z. So people will argue, and actually very few people have made this comparison. So as far as I know, nobody argues, but I will just say it, that FRP evaluation, you can look at it and say, oh, it's better or more capable because it supports discrete propagation, which is this idea that if a value, regardless of whether a value changes, the fact that somebody tried to change it, you know, that it was there was an attempt to manipulate this input source, that causes propagation. Okay, so FRP, it's pretty neat, but, you know, I mean, people are doing neat things with it. A lot of Rx is inspired by the event stream side of FRP. In fact, an observable in Rx is basically an FRP event stream. And I think there's a use case there for using event streams and retaining the sequence notion of events over time when you're doing a lot of side effects. And when you're not particularly interested in retaining values that are being calculated, and you're more just interested in this dependency order capability of FRP systems, you have some workflow and you want it to happen in a particular order. FRP, the whole order piece that it maintains on your behalf, that's useful for stuff like this. And one place to look at how people are using this is there's a talk, at least slides available for how Netflix is using RxJava. And if you look at their use of observables, it's mostly around workflows and doing I/O. But I don't think FRP is not particularly, or I don't think it is particularly awesome in ClojureScript. And I say that after having done a bunch of it myself. And the person I worked with Javelin on, who's responsible for at least half of it, probably more, he may have written probably the most functional reactive ClojureScript code of anybody alive, maybe. And we both came to the same conclusion. It's not particularly awesome. It encourages a way of structuring your program where you litter these behaviors in this big graph that represents your application behavior. So now the state of your application, instead of being in one place, is distributed all over the place in this graph, because you are mixing discrete and continuous, you are mixing event streams and behaviors. Once you have event streams, in order to control what your program does, you need to introduce a special kind of control structure, because now you are potentially want to control or express what your program does in the absence of any values. So now we're in a world where there are no values to work with, because we can't depend on event streams to have had a value yet. We bring in our own control structures, and now we're looking at things like if e. You know, it was wild when functions that ended with a capital E. Now you're looking at if, cond, control structures that end in a capital E. Some of them end in capital B. It gets out of hand very quickly. At some point in the evolution of FRP, somebody had this idea, which is sort of like a very like hanging out with your buddies in the van. Maybe, dude, what if we put an event stream in an event stream? Like, what would that like? Dude. And that's a thing, and people have done it. And to reason about it, it requires a serious type system, which, again, we don't have. It requires a type system for the same reason that a lot of functional composition, you know, people like to do that kind of stuff in a language with a legit type system. And it's hard to debug, unless you have one. I mean, again, I have my awesome one, but you may not be so equipped. There is this overlap between the event stream and the behavior APIs. And I can't, you have to work with it a while to get a sense of distaste for this overlap. But if you go to the Flapjacks page and look at their documentation page, you'll see it immediately, because they have all the functions that do stuff with event streams. They have all the functions that do stuff with behaviors. And a lot of them are the same, but end in E. Or like, oh, that's like the one from behavior, except ends in B. There's like 5, 10 of those. And that's just strange. That's an indication to me that something is not right with the model. Again, this is just my opinion. Finally, there isn't an integration point, a clear integration point, with the facilities we have in Clojure already for managing state. Now, granted, ClojureScript doesn't have much of an awesome state thing going on. I mean, we have an atom, and atoms are useful, and it's actually really nice to look at code and to write code that could potentially run on Clojure, you know, state-related, state management code. But, you know, we want things that are dereferable. We want things that are swappable. We want things that we can integrate cleanly with our existing model. And one of the things to keep in mind, if you're looking at any other language and trying to pull some idea over, is, you know, keep in mind that the people that worked on that, they didn't have a lot of things we took for granted. And they came up with a solution for those things in their model. But you kind of have to pull off if you want to get anything good off of it. So, you know, FRP comes from languages that don't really have the notion of a reference, you know, a reference type. So they kind of include that idea in the library. So here's Javelin. Javelin does the opposite of everything I've just been talking about, except for spreadsheets. Javelin is an abstract spreadsheet library for programming with values. Javelin hates event streams. In fact, they're not even, it's not even possible to construct them or anything like that in Javelin. It's all value-oriented, the same way a spreadsheet is. It's delivered to you as a single thing, a macro, called the cell macro, which is hyper-magical. It's funny. I credit my friend Misha with having the imagination to do this, which is basically create a macro that you write closure code inside of, and we automatically walk it, reactify it, lift it, do all kinds of wild stuff. Because, you know, this runs against my closure sensibilities. Like, dude, a macro, we're code walking, doing all kinds of transforms, lifting. Dude, he's like, dude, let's give it a try. So we tried it, and it's great. It's really, really great. It lets us write code that looks and feels like the closure code we're used to. And we're, you know, programming at a spreadsheet level. No callbacks in sight. Man, it's just sweet. So what does this crazy macro look like to use? Well, here we're declaring an input cell. And an input cell is an input cell like one you might see in spreadsheets. This is a cell that is supposed to be updated by some process outside of the graph, this dependency graph. This is a formula cell. A formula cell is a cell that has a function and some number of other dependencies on other cells, which can be either formula cells or input cells. Now, in this case, this particular formula is saying, my value is whatever the value of A is, plus 1. Okay? Now, we have another formula cell here. This formula cell is saying, my value is, you know, whatever, 123 plus A, the value of the cell A, and plus B, the value of the formula cell B, is. This cell is an anonymous formula cell. Notice we're not binding it to a name anywhere. Our kind of convention that we've been following, and again, this is... Javelin is pretty weird. There's really nothing like Javelin, so we're kind of inventing idioms and ways of working with it that make sense. And this one seems to, which is if a cell is for output, we don't name it. So here we're calling dot JS console C, which is logging the value of C. What that demonstrates also partly is that our deep magic that the cell macro is doing works on method calls. In fact, we've pretty thoroughly debugged the cell macro, so we're no longer running into closure code that it can't automagicize. So this is how you do mutation. This is exactly how you mutate closure atoms. So we have our input cell A, which again is an input cell. It's designed to be, well, our intent anyway is that you can swap bang stuff on it. So we're saying increment the value of A. And what this causes to happen is propagation, because the value of A has changed. It was 0, now it's 1. Javelin does continuous propagation. This new value now trickles through our graph in a dependency order way. So all of the intermediate values, or all of the intermediate functions in our dependency graph, see values that are consistent with each other. This is super key. This is exactly the thing you do not get with callbacks. If you wire your stuff up with callbacks, you do not get consistency. And then you can dereference things, just like you dereference a closure atom. So you can dereference either a formula cell or an input cell at any point in time, just like you would with an atom. All right, so here's a little more about this idea of consistency. This is a little graph that represents the code on the left. We have three cells, A, B, and C. B depends on A, and C depends on A and B. That's kind of tricky, because the value of B is derived from the value of A. So it's important that the value of B and the value of A that C sees are both the same. Rather, they're consistent with one another. This property of these values being consistent with one another with respect to how we arrange these dependencies is called being glitch-free. That's a word from signal processing, and I guess it's important there. And it comes up in FRP literature. Okay, so that's cool. There's not much to Javelin except this macro and your ability to swap bang and dereference stuff in it. But Javelin has certain opinions, which at this point are written only on this slide, which are maybe helpful to you if you try and use Javelin to write web apps. The first is that Javelin takes a pretty strong stance, or as Steve Miner would say, the guide says that a web application is exactly in one state at any given time. There is one state. There's one state in your program at any point in time. And that you should store that state. Again, this is not me. This is like the guide. The guide has this strong opinion that you should store that value in an input cell. And there should be one such input cell per, you know, your application. This is where you put your one state. We call that input cell the stem cell because it's the cell from which all the other cells on your page are derived. Everything else on your page is going to be a formula of that core data, which is the essential data of your application. So everything the user then sees or can do is governed by the contents of this stem cell or formula cells that are derived from this value. What this encourages you to do is to think about the kind of data that you are essentially storing in your application. What is the core data from which all the other data is derived? And what we found in practice using Javelin is that that's often a very small amount of data. We have a lot of data that we end up, you know, we dump a lot of data in the outhouse that's related to displaying various aspects of what the state is. We do all kinds of calculations sometimes on what the data is, but it's usually very small, you know, a map with, I don't know, 20 keys tops, and we've written some pretty large apps now with Javelin. So what is a real Javelin app? Well, again, Javelin is this thing that you can use without a DOM library if you want. I haven't tried to use it on Node or anything, but maybe it would work there because it has no dependencies other than ClojureScript. We use two other things. The first is HLISP. Again, this is this space-age HTML. It's not even, it's like, if the Martians had a templating language, it would probably look like this. Pretty awesome. Then we have a thing called Wigwam, which is a piece of server client RPC machinery. And basically, this gives us the ability to have stem cells that are remote. So we have this ability to build FRP graphs of Javelin cells where constituent cells may be on the network, maybe not. That gives us some architectural power. Both of these things are available at this URL, and I'll post these links, and that's clickable and everything. When you put it all together, you get a diagram that looks kind of like this. This is sort of our architecture. This is how Javelin integrates into the way we are building applications currently. On the server side, we have Datomic. Access to Datomic is mitigated by some web application, which is running Wigwam. This is our RPC layer. Wigwam has, for every client, that client's stem cell. That stem cell is transferred to the client over the wire under various conditions. Maybe the client asks for it. Maybe we push it to them. Doesn't matter. Anytime the value of that stem cell changes, change is propagated down to all the dependent formula stem cells, which may be doing different kinds of calculations. Like maybe part of the stem cell data in our chat app is there are five people in, you know, there are five people in the room. One of the derived things might be you know, how many of those people are online. So now we're filtering through them. It's a formula of the stem cell data. Then HLISP handles the transference of the cell data into the DOM. And an important point about this model is that we never send events or do any mutation in intermediate places in our dependency graph. So we never swap any intermediate cells in our dependency graph. All of the events from the user go directly to Wigwam, and Wigwam is responsible for generating the next stem cell for that client. So I think I'm about out of time. If you're interested in seeing Javelin work, you can just type in Javelin ClojureScript, and you'll get to our GitHub repo. We have some demos and things. And certainly, if you just have questions, feel free to approach myself or my colleague Nisha, and we'd be happy to answer them. So thank you very much.